Hello, and welcome back to A Place for Film, the official IU Cinema podcast. I am your host, David Carter, and I'd like to welcome you back to another episode for another week. This is going to be a very casual episode since I did drop two episodes in the feed last week. So instead of going in depth and having to do a lot of research about a lot of different things, I just kind of wanted to talk about some things that are relevant to the IU Cinema and movies at large, and also just gives me an excuse to talk about Jackass Forever. So this week's episode is just going to be me kind of gushing about Jackass Forever. But before we do that, I'm going to talk about the recent Oscar nominees that were just announced this past week and just give my like very brief thoughts. Nothing very controversial. There were some weird snubs and some weird nominations, but this does feel closer to a traditional Oscar race, I guess, than the Oscar race from last year, which was obviously this weird lockdown pandemic anomaly of nominations and circumstances. So it's kind of interesting to see all these things that kind of were held back all come out in 2021 and then see how everything shook out for certain films and how they didn't shake out for certain films. So I'll get into that. And other than that, I've been doing okay. I recently just watched Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy on HBO Max, which if you don't know, Steven Soderbergh is in what's called his No More Masterpieces era, which he had this whole thing he went on about how he's done just trying to fine tune and make like intricately made masterpieces, and that he's just gonna have fun and make films, specifically genre films that interest him. And it's been great. He has this like deal with HBO Max, and he put out No Sudden Move last year, which was one of the best films of the year. So for films that he's just kind of making on a lark, doing an incredible job. Kimmy is no different. Kimmy is, I would say it's Blowout, but with Alexa is kind of the elevator pitch for it. Zoe Kravitz plays someone who has agoraphobia that is then exacerbated by the pandemic, which I remember there was a person online who was like really grumpy that we had all these auteurs making films that were only taking place in the past and were like memory plays and, you know, filled with nostalgia. And they were kind of grumpy that there were no auteurs making films set in present day. And Steven Soderbergh feels like he just shrugged his shoulders and he was like, okay. And so, yeah, this is a movie set during the pandemic. It's set in modern day. There is a pandemic and they don't belabor it, but it's also an important element to making the movie work. Steven Soderbergh's a genius. I don't know what else to say. But yeah, if you like Blowout or any of those 70s political or conspiracy thrillers, or if you like the film Rear Window, this is a movie for you. Solid 3.5 to 4-star burner, a tight 89 minutes. Zoe Kravitz gives a great performance as someone who just has a lot of social anxieties and not a lot of people skills as she's trying to uncover a conspiracy behind a recording that she found as her job. As imagine if Alexa, instead of an algorithm, you know, correcting things as you've like Alexa do this thing and then it doesn't understand. There's a team of people who, when that happens, it gets flagged and then they go in and they kind of listen and they log an error report and try to fix the problem and then move on to the next problem. That is her job. That is why she hears some audio that she shouldn't be hearing. But I won't get too much into the movie. I think you'll like it. There's some good bit parts from some character actors and comedians in the movie that I was happy to see pop up. And once again, you can find that on HBO Max. But enough about streaming options. Let's talk about our in-person options and virtual options at the IU Cinema for the week of February 14th. Recently added to the IU Cinema schedule on Tuesday, February 15th at 7 p.m. for $4, we have the double feature Made Up Story and Worst Woman. This is a part of our An Evening with Kim Jong-kwan. And before I get into the specifics of what this program is and what it's in relation to and what the films are themselves, just something I always have to get out of the way when I do the schedule. Please note, masks are required for all attendees and the IU Cinema staff at indoor events. Due to our limited screening schedule and currently reduced seating capacity, we strongly encourage patrons to buy tickets online in advance to avoid getting sold out, and there will be no standby or late seating. Please remember all those things and get your tickets in advance. And what is this program? Well, An Evening with Kim Jong-kwon. iCinema is thrilled to host Korean director Kim Jong-kwon this February in 2022 as a part of the IU Arts and Humanities Council Korea Remix program. And for those who don't know what Korea Remix, it's part of a long-standing series of programs that take different countries and explore films and life and culture and art in the 21st century in those countries. So throughout the spring semester of 2022, Korea Remixed, IU Arts and Humanities Council 5th Annual Global Remix Festival celebrates Indiana University's ties to the people, art, and ideas that make Korean culture so integral to the global culture of the 21st century. The festival invites students, faculty, and other community members to engage with visiting artists and scholars, as well as IU's own campus collections, academic experts, and artists, all of whom expand our understanding of Korean culture and remix revered traditions with new modes of expression to create startling new worlds that challenge, enlighten, and inspire. And you can find the full festival schedule and list of exhibitions on the Korea Remixed website. And then as to who is Kim Jong-kwon, director Kim first gained prominence with his innovative independent short form works, but his 2016 debut feature, Worst Woman, signaled his quick ascent as one of South Korea's newest voices in feature filmmaking. Thematically focused on contemporary human condition, director Kim's work explores the complex nuances of identity, interpersonal connections, and the frailty of human relationships, balancing meditations on morality, emotionality, and the weight of memory. Director Kim studiously avoids melodrama or sentimentality, instead allowing his pensive filmmaking and restrained editing to reveal how his characters navigate the complexities of everyday human experience, ordinary and extraordinary alike. He released two films in 2021, Josie and the Shades of the Heart. The latter features K-pop superstar IU. IU also starred in Kim's episode of the Netflix anthology hit Persona from 2019 titled Walking the Night. IU Cinema will screen two of director Kim's films, the 2021 short Made Up Story, followed by Worst Woman, director Kim's 2016 breakout feature. After screening two of Kim's films, the audience will be treated to a pre-recorded conversation between director Kim and Darcy Paquette. Paquette is the founder of the KoreanFilm.org and author of New Korean Cinema, Breaking the Wave, from 2010. IU Cinema is excited to be working in partnership with the Institute for Korean Studies and the IU Arts and Humanities Council to host one of Korea's vital new cinematic voices. And as far as what each of these films are about, the first film is a short 30 minutes called Made Up Story. Uses conversation between two friends to interrogate identity, construction, memory, and the connection between narrative, imagination, and culture. This is in Korean with subtitles. And Worst Woman follows Yoon Hee, played by Han Ye-ri, an actress who creates different personalities and identities when she meets men through her life. One day after encountering three different men, Yoon Hee's persona begins slipping and merging, and she is forced to reconcile her true self with her invented identities and come to terms with the consequences of her performances. This is also in Korean with subtitles. So once again, that is recently added, and that is on Tuesday, February 15th at 7 p.m., and it is $4 for everyone. Next up, on Thursday, February 17th at 7, for $4 for everyone, we have the next film in our 5 by Douglas Sirk Magnificently Obsessed series. Me and Michaela Owens, our publications editor, did a whole introduction to Douglas Sirk, so I won't belabor that. But this will hopefully be our first in-person screening of the Douglas Sirk series. Sadly, All That Heaven Allows was snowed out by the snowstorm, which was annoying because I was excited to introduce it. Had this whole thing where I was going to fold the Matrix Resurrections into the introduction. Lost the time now. But this is from 1947, and this is starring Lucille Ball. A serial killer is on the loose in London, luring young women into his web through ads placed in the personal column. Scotland Yard's bait to ensnare the villain is a young dance hall girl played by Lucille Ball, who encounters a series of likely suspects, including the always dashing George Sanders as a sophisticated playboy and the unforgettable Boris Karloff as a mad fashion designer. This is restored from a 35mm print. So exciting to see a Douglas Sirk film, even a black and white one on 35. Man knew how to shoot a movie. Lucille Ball is gorgeous in this movie. Well, Lucille Ball is just gorgeous all the time. A fact we overlook when we talk about Lucille Ball because she's so funny, but an incredibly amazing, funny, beautiful woman. So this is a kind of a slightly deeper cut for Douglas Sirk. So absolutely behooves you to come out and see this one. I have a soft spot in my heart for Lourdes. So I hope you check it out. And once again, is on Thursday, February 17th at 7 p.m. on Friday, February 18th at 7, we have a virtual event for the film And Then They Came For Us. And some notes about our virtual events, as I always give. Be sure, if you want to participate in this virtual event, to have downloaded the Zoom software to the device that you want to watch the event on. Register for the February 18th Zoom webinar to receive a link through which you will join the event at the time and date noted. To watch the film, you must tune into the live Zoom event. At the end of the film introduction, a slide will appear with instructions on how to watch the film, which will include a web address as well as a password. The slide will also display a countdown clock indicating when the post-film Q&A will begin. Please note that the film will not screen via Zoom. You will need to open a web browser, type in the web address, and press enter. And we recommend keeping Zoom webinar window open while watching the film so you can view the countdown clock to the start of the post-film Q&A. If you have any more questions about this, please visit the Virtual Cinema Frequently Asked Questions website. We are working with our film distribution friends at Good Docs to bring you the film And Then They Came For Us. A limited number of complimentary passes will be available to watch the film on a first-come, first-served basis. Filmmaker Abby Ginsberg and one of the film's subjects, Suski Ina, will be present for a virtual conversation interactive Q&A, as I mentioned before. And the film itself is from 2017, directed by Abby Ginsberg and Ken Schneider. And Then They Came For Us is a cautionary and inspiring tale for all societies. In 1942, President Roosevelt signed the Executive Order 9066, paving the way for the forced incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans. The film educates audiences about the constitutional damage done in the name of national security due to war hysteria and racism. Featuring actor George Takei and others who were incarcerated, rediscovered photos of Dorothea Lange and the story of Fred Korematsu's long journey to justice. The film brings history into present as it follows Japanese Americans speaking out against the current Muslim travel ban and other regressive immigration policies. And if you want to learn more about the directors and the subject, Dr. Satsuki Ina, please go to the IU Cinema website for a short biography of both. And as I said again, this is a virtual event, so it is free and there's no ticket required. But please follow those instructions that I gave at the beginning of the episode as to how you can participate in it. And that is, once again, February 18th at 7 p.m. And finally, a rare Monday screening also recently added. On Monday, February 21st at 7 p.m., we have a free but ticketed screening of Speak Up. This is a screening supported by the French and Italian Department, the Center of Excellence of the French Embassy in the United States, the College of Arts and Humanities Institute, the African Studies Program, the Media School, the Center for Documentary Research and Practice, the College Office of Diversity and Inclusion, the Black Film Center and Archive, Mary Margaret Barr Kuhn Fund, and the Department of Comparative Literature. So this is a team effort to get this film screened. This is a documentary from 2017 directed by Amandine Gay. In Speak Up, Amandine Gay creates an intimate conversation with Black women located in Francophone Europe. They open up about their experiences of discrimination in interviews filmed in close-ups and take control over their own representation and stage on-screen performances. Using an Afro-feminist approach, this committed documentary highlights the necessity of reclaiming the narrative. What does it mean for women to exist in countries promoting a post-race ideology? And this is in French with subtitles. This is another screening in which there will be a conversation after the screening. It will be filmmaker Amandine Gay and producer Enrico Bertolucci. And they are scheduled to be in conversation moderated by Dr. Elena Guzman. Once again, that is Monday, February 21st at 7 p.m. It is free but ticketed. And with that, that's going to do it for us for the IU Cinema schedule. And now to talk about, very briefly, the 2022 Oscar nominees.
Who will be the baby of the year? Look at their roles. Look at their folds. Look at their rummy, bummy tummies. Heads are round, bellies are squishy. Look at the toes, lots of many curls and shrimp.
Are they ticklish? This past Tuesday morning, in the wee hours of the morning, were the announcement of the 2022 Oscar nominations. And while this was the first year in a long time, I actually did not wake up. Well, I was awake anyway, but I just forgot to tune into it, if I'm going to be completely honest. But I did not watch it as it went down, so I got all the reactions after everyone else had already seen them. But as I was saying earlier in the episode, this is kind of a return to a more traditional Oscar nomination pool, since the movies that were all supposed to come out in 2020 came out in 2021. So he had this like glut of like high quality movies, which meant that there are some baffling snubs, or just people have short memories. You know, the way the Oscars work, to my knowledge, is that nominations are decided by each pool. So it's like, if you're a composer, you nominate with other composers in the Academy for who is going to be nominated for best score. And then the Academy as a whole votes on who will be the winner. So it's interesting when certain people get left out, because it's like, man, did your branch of the Academy just completely forget? Anyway, I don't want to like make this segment incredibly long. As a matter of fact, I want to keep it very short. So I would say the most interesting things being that Denzel Washington, I think this is his 8th nomination, and he has now been nominated for an Oscar over the last 5 decades. He's been nominated in the 80s, 90s, aughts, 2010s, and 2020s for The Tragedy of Macbeth. That is great. And Steven Spielberg, a very similar pedigree, nominated over the last 6 decades, from the 70s to the 2020s. And honestly, I just got to get this off my chest about Steven Spielberg. It drives me crazy that there was a period where we did, but we still don't talk about Steven Spielberg the same way we talk about Martin Scorsese, as like the film brats who had longevity and are these like virtuosos of like technique and have this like giant spring of knowledge and film history that they just pop out whenever it suits them. Steven Spielberg, to me, like, I think it's like one of those, he's so good, we take him for granted, but he is, to me, the successor to Alfred Hitchcock. Sorry, Brian De Palma, as weird as that is to say, but he is a technician that like elevates whatever material that he's working on. And he just takes and runs with it. Like, he made Ready Player One a watchable movie. And while I'm still not quite on the Ready Player One is actually good train, it still kind of gets on my nerves. But watching it, you know, this movie could have been so much worse. The entire race sequence is just like him just shredding. I don't know. I love Steven Spielberg. So everything deserved. West Side Story was like one of my top 5 movies of last year. It makes me so sad that more people didn't actually get to see that in the theater. When the AMCs do their inevitable, we're going to play all the Best Picture nominees and Oscar nominees. Like, please go see West Side Story. And I'm going to say this, and I can't believe I'm saying it after I did a whole episode about how the Robert Wise West Side Story is my favorite musical of all time. I think, after sitting on this for long enough, I think Spielberg's version of West Side Story is actually better. And it's weird to say that out loud, but I think it's true. So please check out West Side Story at your earliest convenience, preferably on a big screen. It's just, the man knows how to use a camera, but don't want to spend too long on Steven Spielberg. Actually kind of pulling from the win Best Director, despite the Best Director category being insane. Speaking of which, in Best Director, we have Kenneth Branagh for Belfast, which we played at the Heartland International Film Festival this year. Ryusuke Hamaguchi for Drive My Car, another film where the Academy gave it a surprising amount of nominations. I think it's 4 for picture, director, screenplay, and foreign film. Well-deserved, incredible movie. Unfortunately, as I'm recording this episode, its last screenings at the Ryder are happening, but I hope you got to catch it. And if you didn't, please watch this movie. This is like one of the best slow burn meditative movies about human connection and tragedy like I have ever seen. I haven't really stopped thinking about it. It kind of really grew on me after watching it over time. Like, I immediately loved it, but I didn't know how long it was actually going to stick with me. So Drive My Car, real deal. Really proud of the Academy for nominating in some interesting categories. But continuing Best Director category, we have Paul Thomas Anderson for Licorice Pizza. Would also be stoked if he won. Jane Campion for Power of the Dog, who was nominated way back for when she did The Piano. And this is her 2nd nomination, the first female director to ever be nominated twice. And if she were to win this Oscar, she would be the 3rd ever woman to ever win Best Director. I think the previous 2 winners being Kathryn Bigelow and Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, and Steven Spielberg for West Side Story. Honestly, maybe with the exception of Belfast, because I haven't seen it, and I actually do. Look, I love Kenneth Branagh. The man doesn't know how to make anything subtle. It's all blown out. Can't wait to force people to watch his like unabridged version of Hamlet at some point. I like his version of Murder on the Orient Express. I'm kind of excited to see Death on the Nile. But of these 5 directors, clearly there are 4 that should walk away with this. I don't know who's the heavy favorite. I know probably PTA and Spielberg probably aren't going to get it, because Power of the Dog's nominated for 12 Oscars. So I would assume that, like, this is the heavy favorite. I don't know if it's going to walk away with all 12. I would actually doubt it. But great job, Academy, on the Best Director nominations. And, you know, outside of that, I mean, there's the, like, the big Don't Look Up discourse. Look, just put it on record. Don't Look Up is a bad movie, but it comes from somewhere very real is my best defense of it. As in, like, I think that Adam McKay is like us and we're all kind of panicking about climate change. And he made a movie that is just shouting at you about it, but it's not particularly good or funny, but it's also connecting with people. And so I'm kind of two minds about it, as in it was a big bummer to watch that on Christmas Day. And look, I respect the ending of that movie. The ending of that movie is the best part about that movie. I'm kind of on team maybe satire isn't possible or as possible in 2022 because our lives have become satire. Is this Oscar material? What is Oscar material? I don't know. I just don't really like hearing about the movie anymore because it's, I get it. It's climate change. I know it sucks. But this isn't Adam McKay's best movie. Like, he really hasn't made anything. If we're talking about his post Other Guys career, the credit sequence of the Other Guys is exactly where you can split Adam McKay's filmography into two different eras. There is the things he did with, like, Will Ferrell and all those guys, and then there is everything he made from the credit sequence of the Other Guys, where it's talking about insider trading and all that stuff, you know, followed up by The Big Short and Vice and Don't Look Up. I am a moderate Vice defender. I do find it interesting to watch, and I like how kind of cartoonish the performances are, and it moves at a clip. Unpopular opinion. I think Big Short is just unambiguously good movie. Don't Look Up is just not great. There's a lot of wasted talent in it. So its nomination in Best Picture and some other categories, I just kind of shrug. But I would say that's, like, you know, one of the glaring nominations. And I am excited to see that, you know, Nightmare Alley's been having this big, like, directors standing up for Guillermo and, like, being like, this movie's actually good. And, like, I actually didn't dislike that movie. I'm excited to rewatch it in the very near future. It's currently on HBO Max and Hulu, but I'm excited to see that walk away with, like, some, like, costume design and production design, because if there's anything you can not say about that movie is that it's not gorgeously designed. So good for that movie. Kind of hope that it has a nice reclamation. I would like to do, like, a back-to-back-to-back of the book, the original movie, which I love, and the remake, because I love Guillermo del Toro. And this was kind of his big, like, Oscar follow-up. Like, I've been listening to Blank Check's series on Jane Campion, and they just did Portrait of a Lady, which was her follow-up to The Piano. She has a lot of P titles in her filmography. And that movie not being as well-received as The Piano, and that's kind of what Nightmare Alley kind of feels like. But much like Nightmare Alley, like, I actually really do like Portrait of a Lady. So, yeah, hopefully people could come around to it as, like, you know, this sumptuous design piece with interesting performances in it. It's one of the few Bradley Cooper performances I like. I'll leave it at that. And I would say, you know, there was no world in which I ever thought Matrix Resurrections was going to get anything but maybe some technical awards. But that's been completely shot out here. Came out too late in last year, so I understand. Oh, also very cute that Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons are both nominated for Power of the Dog. Will they both win? I don't know. Probably not, but it would be cute if they both went home with Oscars. As far as the biggest snub to me, it's gotta be The French Dispatch. And look, I understand, which is so crazy to me. I never understand it, but I understand that people are like, I don't like Wes Anderson, or too much oversaturation, or too quirky, too twee. The same arguments people have been making for, like, the last probably closer to 30 years than 20 years at this point. But that movie is, to me, I think that Grand Budapest Hotel is objectively his best movie. It may not be my favorite movie. I think it might actually be my favorite movie of his, but objectively his best movie. This is him in that same sicko mode of, like, the technicality is incredible. The stories are all funny. They're all very poignant. Two of them, like, made me cry. Every performance is completely dialed in. And it's weird that we can consider Wes Anderson movies as, like, art house movies, because they're not actually all that. Like, they're very straightforward in, like, what types of jokes. It's just a lot of deadpan humor and, like, very well-composed sight gags and composition. I think that's what makes people think they're, like, art house movies, but to me, they're just, like, very good comedies. But completely shut out. Crazy to me. Don't know how it didn't at least get production design or score or cinematography or costume design, like, hair and makeup. There's just a lot of, I don't understand why the Academy was, like, shrugged, like, well, whatever. So, sorry, Wes. It was one of my favorite movies of last year. Really hope people get to check it out. despite weirdly it never playing in Bloomington. I don't know why. Never played at AMC. Never played at any of the multiple movie venues. Kind of thinking about Cicada should probably just play it, despite it being a very well-known and popular movie. I would like people to see this on the big screen. So I would say that's like the biggest head scratcher of a snub that I saw. There are probably other ones people are shouting at their podcast app, like telling me about. But other than that, I think a solid crop of nominees. I won't get into like every single category, but you know, there's things I'm happy about. Glad that Summer of Soul is and Flea were nominated for documentary feature. We played Flea at the Heartland Film Festival, and Summer of Soul just kicked off my movie year right. I love that movie. Probably overdue for a rewatch anyway. And oh, Worst Person in the World also coming in. This is one of my favorite films of last year that also hasn't played in Bloomington yet, by Joachim Trier, who I best known for a movie called Thelma. This is like, I've heard described as Francis Ha, but about your 30s as opposed to your 20s, which I think is a little reductionist to what the film actually is. It's kind of, even as you are entering your 30s, you still don't have to have life all figured out, and about a relationship ending, not because it is anything necessarily bad has happened or things have grown stale and ugly or anything like that, just because you are in a new place in life than the person that you are seeing and you want to try something new. Love that movie. Interestingly filmed and edited and score. Oh, I love thinking about it. And that was nominated for Best International Feature Film and Screenplay. So very happy about that. My biggest hot take is that I actually don't really like the Dune score, and I can really tell when Hans Zimmer's phoning it in. So I hate that they just give it to him no matter what the movie is. Just give Hans Zimmer a nomination every year. And I know you phoned it in, Hans. This ain't your best work. It's an okay theme, though. Anyway. I'm going to end Oscar talk there, but please make sure to tune into the Academy Awards on March 27th. I'm almost positive I'll do another follow-up Academy Awards episode, because it is my Super Bowl. And I really hope, speaking of the Super Bowl, really hope the Bengals won. Shout out to past IU Cinema guest Peter Schomburg, owner of the Bengals Museum, aka his college bedroom. Anyway, with that, we will now turn to me giving a very short review of Jackass Forever.
You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd. But you can be happy if you've mine too. You can't take
so, over the past few weeks, as I've been saying at the beginning of a lot of these episodes, I've been watching through the Jackass movies for the first time since catching them on a combination of seeing them on MTV, probably, and then also, and probably Comedy Central, if I had to guess, and then also this would be the first time I ever actually got to see one in theaters, because I sadly didn't get to see Jackass 3D in theaters. But an interesting vestige of the 20th century. There will never be, and you know, never say never, especially because this movie has a like cadre of new Jackass members, which actually all of them rule. Very healthy addition to this series. I loved all of them, especially Poopies, mostly because his name is Poopies. Very interesting vestige of the 20th century. I mean, I think Johnny Knoxville is one of the most charismatic people to ever have lived. I saw him described, I think, in a review by Matt Zoller's site as the love child between Brad Pitt and Beetlejuice. And I think that's like a pretty apt description of what makes him so alluring. Just a man who just kind of down for anything over these courses of films. Like, you see him almost die multiple times on screen. Like, there are accidents. I specifically think about the rocket stunt in the third movie. There are three Johnny Knoxville stunts I think about a lot over the course of these four movies. The rocket stunt in Jackass 3, where it misfires the first time and a rocket flies out from the side of it, and if it had been moved up about 6 inches, Johnny Knoxville would be dead. I also think about the bull stunts that he does in every single movie. I'm counting as one thing, but just this one, he gets his bell rung hard. You can tell age is taking a toll, but every time he does this, like, always makes a joke. In the second movie, they do the like teeter-totter like bull rodeo or whatever, and like he's the maniac who like runs back in to keep go, like he has won and he just keeps going. There's the Jackass 3 where he's on roller skates. Always gets me. And then the other one I think about a lot is Jackass 2, the darkest of the Jackass movies. Like, it's the one where it's like all of them have too much money, because, you know, as much as I love these boys, these are not boys who probably made smart decisions with their money. early on, but like have too much money. They're not clean at this point. I know a lot of them have like gotten clean and healthier as these movies have gone on, like especially Steve-O, which is great, which leads to some interesting moments in Jackass 3 and 4 that I would love to talk about. But the one I think about with Johnny Knoxville is the Embassy Riot rubber bullet stunt, where it's Johnny, Bam, and I forget, is it, it might be Ryan Dunn. Rest in peace, Ryan Dunn. There's a nice little tribute to him at the end of this movie if you go see it in theaters, so please stay through the credits for the Ryan Dunn tribute. But it's like they see this mannequin just get annihilated, and then what Johnny Knoxville says, and I never will forget this, is that he says,
"No, all you gotta do is stand there."
Yeah, get killed. Look at that thing. That thing blew
it's just
out.
Loud. It's loud. It's gonna hurt really bad, but it's just loud.
You're nuts.
No. Come on, it's footage.
You're nuts.
And that's how he convinces them. And like, to me, that and the combination of the fact that a lot of these stunts, if he walks away, he makes a joke, or he's just a Looney Tunes character. Like, nothing phases him. He has somehow survived this long. I would doubt that he would do a fifth one of these. Like I said, never say never. But he's the secret to making this work. And I feel like everyone else around him are these integral characters that like amplify certain like aspects of like the Jackass mythos. If I had to say, if I had like a favorite Jackass member that wasn't Steve-O or Johnny Knoxville, I think underrated, I will not my favorite, but I think underrated is Preston Lacey, the bigger guy in the Jackass crew. Does a lot of like fat joke based stunts, but then also a lot of very dangerous thing. Gets paired with Wee Man a lot, my favorite couple in Jackass. But in Jackass Forever, there's this great moment where they're go and it's like it kind of echoes like the first Jackass movie, where they're gonna do this stunt and he's already it's set up and ready to go, and then Preston like poops his pants because he is trying to fart and he poops his pants, and it's like kind of sad, but it because it's so sad and everyone's laughing, you laugh too. These movies give you like this weird catharsis that like you're allowed to laugh at and with people at the exact same time the way you did when you were in high school whenever one of your friends like something bad happened to them, I guess. It takes you back to that and it makes it feel okay. But like he poops his pants and he's just in disbelief and everyone is in tears laughing. And like Johnny, like perfect timing, just says, "Why?" He didn't mean to. And Preston's just like, "I'm a 51-year-old man and I just pooped my pants." I mean, I think Preston's got a lot of like ethos to him. He really steps up in this movie in some of the crazier stunts too. And speaking about people that step up in this movie, this is a very stream of consciousness review, but like speaking of people that step up in this movie, we have Danger Aaron. So for me, the arc of Danger Aaron in these movies is that I would say the first movie, like kind of for me personally, like almost a non-entity. But then the second movie, it's one of my like my favorite pranks that they've ever done, because it starts one way where you're like, oh no, this is very like Bush era racism. I hate this. Where the prank is going to be, he's gonna play a terrorist and like punk a cab driver. But then the stunt turns out to be about how much of an asshole Danger Aaron is, because he's doing like a very stereotypical Middle Eastern accent and like cadence and everything. He's dressed in a turban, all this stuff. And then everyone shaves their pubic hair and that becomes Danger Aaron's beard for the thing. They have Jay Shander Sekar in on the stunt as the like cab driver. And then they essentially just mentally and physically torture Danger Aaron during the whole stunt, and it feels like a great like what a cathartic prank that goes a much better way. Like he's the butt of the joke, not the other way around, which I appreciate. And then we get to Jackass Forever, and I've put this on my letterbox, and I'm gonna say it in a much more censored way than I did on there, but he steps up in such a big way. His junk gets put through the ringer in this movie. One, there's like a game show where like people are just getting whacked in the junk with like flip-flops if you get an answer wrong. And at the very beginning of it, Johnny Knoxville messes up and like just whacks Danger on accident. So like that sets the tone. And then we go through a sequence which I compare to there's a sequence in the second John Wick movie, John Wick Chapter 2, where he's now excommunicado and like every assassin is like going after him, and it's this nice little montage sequence of him having to go through this gauntlet of like fighting off these like very skilled assassins who all have very different assassination styles. That's what Danger Aaron's junk goes through in this movie. He has a like world heavyweight champion who delivers the most devastating punches recorded on Earth in what is a follow-up to the cup test, the first cup test done by Johnny Knoxville, where he was just kicked in the groin with a cup. And it still hurts no matter what, because a cup just kind of pushes into your crotch. So it still hurts no matter what when you put that much force on the cup test. Just protects you. So that's the first one. Someone with like the fastest softball pitch in the world has time with them. A hockey player goes ham on this cup. And like, if you are weak of heart, it ends with like a pogo stunt on this cup. And I will leave it at that. But because of that, Danger Aaron is like the secret MVP of Jackass Forever. I love it. I don't know. I find these movies to be a fascinating part of Spike Jonze's oeuvre because he's a producer on them and also a participant. He usually plays the old lady in the like old lady doing pranks sketches. Always has like a different design for his old lady, which I appreciate. Knoxville is always Irving Zisman, I think is his name, the bad grandpa character, whereas Spike Jonze is always someone different. Has a small cameo in this movie. I think may have directed the opening of this movie, not to take anything away from director Jeff Tremaine, but the opening to this movie, which is kind of a kaiju riff with Chris Pontius's Pizzone playing the kaiju. I won't say anything more about that. Anyway, I think that might have been directed by him, but I find it like a fascinating part of like, yes, there is Spike Jonze's mannered, low-key, art housey, or like art house darling director of like the 90s and aughts, and like the last movie he's made is her. And you always kind of forget that he's just kind of like a prankster too and loves hanging out with these dudes, gets involved in the action, and you can kind of see, like, I don't know, it all makes sense to me. And this was a very cathartic movie to watch. They've all gotten older. It's crazy that they do as much as they do in this movie. I kind of alluded to it earlier, but with the Steve-O stuff, like, because they've gotten older and he was sober by the third Jackass movie, that it, like, really does make them doing the stunts, like, that much more powerful. In the third Jackass movie, he does the, like, softball. There's, like, a soft or a T-ball stunt where it's just, yeah, they, like, hit a thing that swings directly into his crotch. And right before it, he says, like,
I'm Steve-O. Oh, f***. Why do I have to be Steve-O?
And I think that is, like, the theme for everyone in this movie, where they're like, why am I doing this again? But they're also very happy to be doing it again. I think it also helps having, like, the new cast of Jackasses be so, like, game for everything. And then they add a lot of spice to the movie. You know, this is like I said, this is a vestige of the 20th century, and maybe even say late 19th century, because as Matt Zollersites pointed out in his review, it really does feel like this combination of like sideshow, daredevil stunts, and, you know, things that we would flock to carnivals and rallies for every weekend before, you know, the internet could just give us those things instantly on like our phones when we were much border people. But it doesn't feel garish, weirdly. Like, it feels very good-hearted. And, like, granted, yes, these people are putting their lives in danger. And, like, I know PETA has raised issues with the fact that they use real-life animals in these movies, which is, like, while they're not technically physically harming the animals, like, there is, like, a gray area as to what this would do to an animal psychologically. And so, you know, this feels like this could be the end of an era where people are using, like, animals for purposes like this. Who's to say? And I do appreciate about this movie that there's way less scatological stuff in it. There's still a little bit, but what makes the first two Jackass movies harder to watch is that there's so much scatological stuff. And there is still nothing as bad, and I hold to this. This is the only Jackass stunt I ever skip in any of these movies, is paper cuts. Please tweet or DM me or whatever if you agree with me that paper cuts is the single hardest thing to watch in all four of the Jackass movies. I know it's so silly to say, but I think it is that visceral, you know what a paper cut feels like in the places they're giving them to themselves. They shouldn't be going there. So would love to hear your thoughts on like what the hardest to watch Jackass stunt is. And I got teary-eyed at the Ryan Dunn tribute near the end of the movie. And I got kind of teary-eyed just like thinking like, you know, no, Bam's not in this movie. And that's because of some disputes amongst people. And Ryan Dunn's gone. And you feel their loss when they're not there. But it was nice seeing everybody for the first time in a long time. And if you want a spectacle, be back at the movies, cheering crowd, hooting and hollering. Yeah, Jackass Forever is, I think it will remain one of the best movies of the year, simply if not just because there won't be another movie like it to come out this year. And there may never be another movie like it to come out ever again. So I love Jackass Forever. I hope you love it too, if you are not the faintest of heart and like a good laugh. So with that, that's going to do it for me on A Place for Film this week. If you want to follow me, follow the IU Cinema on all social media at IU Cinema or at Indiana University Cinema. You can follow me on Twitter at Samurai Flicks. You can also follow me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Robert Dolphy. And if you are listening to this, I will once again promote that we have a screening of Sister Street Fighter at the Orbit Room in conjunction with the American Genre Film Archive this Thursday, February 17th. Tickets are $5. We got two screenings, 7:30 and 10 o'clock. Get there early, order a hot dog, order a beer. Come talk to me about martial arts movies as I keep going deeper and deeper down the well. And we'll be back next week with a more IU Cinema-centric episode. But this has been A Place for Film. We'll see you at the movies. Good night.